In spring elections, City of Madison residents decided that Paul Soglin should be mayor for a third time. After being mayor from 1973 to 79, 1989 to 97, Paul Soglin just a few weeks ago became Madison's mayor again. It's an important job running Wisconsin's second largest city. So thanks for doing this Newsmakers interview, Mr. Mayor.
It's a pleasure to do it.
Can I call you the Jerry Brown of Wisconsin politics? You were one of the youngest mayor, perhaps the youngest mayor, and now you and Jerry, he's a little bit older, isn't he?
A couple years older. Do
you feel like the Jerry Brown of Wisconsin politics, Paul?
Well, I don't know how he feels.
I understand.
But, you know, I'll tell you, there's moments where it feels like I never left here once I had arrived in 1973. And then there's other moments where I'm sitting here, boy, this is new, this is different. And I'll tell you this much about this particular election. While winning the very first one was obviously tremendously exciting, there's something very special about having won this last election. I feel really honored to have been selected to lead the city, particularly in these very challenging times.
Well, that's my next question. How are the issues different from 73, 89, and now, sir?
Well, we've had financial problems before. In 73, we were looking a few years later at the oil embargo, the tremendous amount of inflation. Mm-hmm. In the early 90s, we were sort of recovering from the loss of federal revenue sharing, and we had a our own recession of the time. But this is one that's more dramatic, more drastic than anything we've ever had. It was deliberately imposed, and there was really very little we could do to respond.
Well, let's talk about that. The budget that's now is on the governor's desk cuts revenue sharing the city of Madison and cuts transit aids, and it blows up the Regional Transit Authority. And you and I were talking before the taping ran. What are they going to do to housing, sir?
Housing, we're going to lose almost 35 years of deliberation and evolution of ordinances defining the relationship between landlords and the tenants. And one of the things that's going to happen, which is not in the interest of the landlords who are pushing this preemption, is it's going to result in a lot more litigation. They're removing all of the mechanisms we had for landlords and tenants to work together. There'll be a lot more litigation, a lot more cost to everyone.
Well, and not to mention, also on the governor's desk is the concealed carry weapons.
Correct.
Now, talk to me. I heard, I'm a news junkie, so you're going to try a very unique thing. What do you think the city of Madison can do?
Well, it comes down to property rights. We can go back to the Magna Carta. We can go back to the Declaration of Independence. We can go back to the Constitution. But we start out with the premise that a person's home is their castle. And, you know, just as you wouldn't intrude in somebody's home without asking permission to smoke a cigarette, put your feet up on the table, you would think you'd have to ask permission to carry a firearm into somebody's home, into their restaurant, into any property that they own. And what we want to do is create a presumption that until you get permission from that property owner or that leaseholder of the property, you have to get permission.
You've got the city attorney studying this. Do you think this would pass constitutional muster?
I think it would. I don't think there's any question. If you look at the body of law in terms of two areas, first, property rights, which are basically paramount to everything except life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And then you look at the body of law in regards to firearms controls, which makes it very clear that no matter what the Second Amendment says, there reasonable restrictions may be imposed. I think we prevail.
Can you get it passed through the council?
From the feedback I'm getting from our city council members, I think they're probably more enthusiastic than I am.
You've been watching Madison politics since the late 1960s. So how, what about this current group of leaders in the Capitol, Governor Walker and the GOP lawmakers that run the Senate and the Assembly? How are they different, and why are they making it harder to govern the city of Madison, Paul?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is the fundamental nature of the way they're preempting local control. I mean, there used to be a premise among both Republicans and Democrats in this state, and it goes all the way back to fighting Bob La Follette and the progressives, which is, unless this is really an area of statewide concern, leave it up to the locals to make the decision. And we're just seeing a whole flurry of activity of preempting everything from how we can run our own budgets to transportation systems to landlord-tenant relations. That's one thing that's significantly different. The other thing that's significantly different is the whole relationship between the public and the private sector. And there's a group of Republicans who are clearly endangered, and there may be some Democrats like myself who are endangered, where we work from the premise of building public-private partnerships, recognizing that public investment in infrastructure, public investment in human capacity, education, job training, is carefully linked to private investment. And we recognize that in certain circumstances that you can have public investment in private enterprises using things like TIF, tax incremental financing.
Right.
Now we've reached a point where that first body of work, that investment in public investment in infrastructure, is just out the window. Public investment in education is going by the wayside. And finally, where we do have a relationship between the public and private sector, the public sector is now taking all the risk, or I shouldn't say all the risk, but a lot of the risk, and not getting the benefits, not getting the gain.
Do you think the governor and the GOP lawmakers don't like cities? Do they not like Milwaukee, Madison? Or what's the real issue here?
I think there's several things going on. One is just an overt political effort to minimize the political influence of cities like Madison and Milwaukee, to weaken the progressive political base, to weaken us economically. I think the second part of it is ideologically driven, which is this whole notion, simply put by Grover Norquist many years ago, where he said, I want to shrink government down to the size where I can drown it in a bathtub.
In a bathtub, that's right. So you think that's where they're coming from?
Yes.
Are they succeeding?
They've succeeded to date in adoption of the legislation. Whether or not they will be around over the next 6 to 8 years to cement that is still up in the air. If they are, I think we can say goodbye to Wisconsin as we know it.
Say goodbye to Wisconsin.
Yeah. I mean, look at the history of this country.
Do you see us becoming Mississippi, race to the bottom?
Boy, I was reading some of the stuff that's going on in Texas. And Texas is doing more progressive things than Wisconsin is in terms of building a tax base. I never thought the day would come where I'd look to Texas as a role model. But the thing is this: let's be patriots and look back at the history of our country, whether it's the state or whether it's the federal government. Public money was used to invest 200 years ago in the canals, 150 years ago in the railroads.
Yes, to build it.
100 years ago in roads for our cars and our buses and the fledgling trucking industry, 50 years ago for our airports. And it worked. It made us the strongest, most powerful nation, the highest standard of living. And now we're adopting a new economic system which completely contradicts that. Something's wrong here. And I'm very fearful of the consequences.
Which of the elements in the budget that the governor has indicated he will sign are most damaging to Wisconsin's second largest city, Paul? Well, is it the revenue sharing, or is it the transit, or the?
It's a combination of the cuts in the. It's a combination of the cuts in revenue sharing programs, combined with the control of our budget as to how we can levy taxes, control our expenditures, taking that away along with. I mean, you know, we've been a relatively sound fiscal city. Very prudent over the years. You know, I disagreed with some stuff that my predecessor, Dave Cheslevich, did, but I'm looking at a $28 million gap.
Out of a budget of how much, sir? Operating budget?
$250 million.
10% plus. Yep.
Where did that gap come from? Partially cuts in shared revenue, cuts in recycling aids, cuts in transportation aids, and then you add to that our problems with borrowing. I've got that cut down to under $20 million.
Okay.
At least if my colleagues on the city council
will
go along with my recommendations.
Well, the voters that just elected you notice cut in City of Madison services?
Oh, there's no question about that. There's no question there will be service
police,
cuts.
Fire, what?
Everything. I mean, there's no question. The question is, how will we do it, and how bad will it affect our community? We're looking at a range of ideas, and I've got a staff team working on it now. For example, there used to be a period of time where in November we were pretty much at a low point in terms of work demand. Mm-hmm. We may be encouraging everybody on the city staff who wants to go hunting to take off in late November. Okay. Don't come back until after Christmas.
Right.
If they'll take an absence from work without pay, that would be tremendous at that time. As we get into January and February, I'm looking at the possibility of missing garbage collection when things are really frozen. Not rotating brownouts, but maybe rotating closings of fire stations at certain periods of time.
You didn't get elected to make these cuts, did you? Or did you know, given the dialogue?
I knew. I knew. I mean, people thought I was being silly when I was talking about a $14 to $18 million gap. Little did I know I was actually going to start out with a $28 million
gap.
Though now we're getting it to closer to the $18 million. No, I knew that. Whether or not people took me seriously, I can't tell you. But you know, there's something else that I wanted to mention when we're talking about the revenue sharing. Madison is about 8% of the state's population. We provide close to 14% of the state's sales tax revenues.
Wow.
Think about that. I mean,
six percentage points more.
That's just a phenomenal proportion. We don't have the data yet on the income tax. We're working on getting that and other tax revenues. But those numbers should be pretty similar. We do benefit from being the state capital.
Yeah.
We benefit from being the home of the University of Wisconsin. And the point is, we have not been selfish. We have used that opportunity very effectively, very dynamically. We have been an economic hub for the state. And when you look at how much we generate in sales tax, income, and all the rest of the taxes, what we send to state government, which is then distributed to the rest of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. we are doing a tremendous job. We have been unselfish in this, and I'm fearful that by hurting Madison this way, the rest of the state's going to suffer as well.
You used to teach at the UW, maybe you still do part-time. I teach one class at the UW, and one thing I do with my students is I tear down the City of Madison budget, and I'm always struck, what percent of your operating budget comes from property taxes? Isn't it more than 60%?
It's 73%. It's an outrageous number.
And it's the highest in the state, isn't it?
And yet, by highest in the state, by yards.
Yes.
And our state is already high compared to the rest of the United States.
Right.
And the point is this. Not only are we getting close to 73% of our 75% of our revenues from the property tax, but when you look at our expenditures, our spending is on par with the rest of the state.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was mayor, we were usually about 10% lower than the average for statewide.
In terms of some of the cost of these services?
Yes.
Including the emergency.
So now the question is if we're not outrageous spenders, despite being Madison with that liberal reputation, we are not high spenders. If we're not, then why are our property taxes so high?
Especially when Madison contributes 14% of all sales taxes with 8% of the, that's numbers that are new to me, sir. You're a student. You came to Madison as a student. You're still a student. When you went up to the Capitol to watch the mass protests in February and March, what were your impressions as someone who has, in the 60s, I was in Madison in the 60s, you were on the streets then. Any comparison, sir?
Other than we were at the Capitol, no.
No.
It was a completely different.
How was it different, Paul?
Well, there's so many ways. Let me tell you some of the differences.
Thank
First
you.
Of all, in terms of the anti-war years, it took a decade to turn out 20, 25,000 people. I mean, here within a matter of weeks, we reached that number, exceeded it, and we're well up over 100,000. That's the first thing.
Yep.
The second thing, the spirit of it. While people felt just as intensely in the 60s about the Vietnam War as they do now about what Governor Walker has done, there was greater compassion now and respect for one another in the sense that folks weren't going off and doing their own thing, which was to bring repression and repercussions for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
As they used to say during the 60s, our biggest problem was keeping the crazies under control so they didn't go off and do something that would trigger a police action. We didn't have that. The presence of so many seniors, so many disabled people who felt comfortable coming up to the square, and people who brought infants and children, just changed the whole atmosphere. And tell you a story about the day. I estimated the crowd that one Saturday at close to 120,000. I think it was the first or second Saturday in March. So, all right, say we have 100,000 people on a square. Now, in most communities, if you have 100,000 people, you're going to have 1,000 marching in the parade and 99,000 watching. Well, this being Madison, Wisconsin, we had 99,000 people marching and just a handful of us watching. And it dawned on me as a candidate, don't go to the front of the parade and march. Only the people who are walking around the square are going to see you.
Mm-hmm.
Stand on the curb. Be all by yourself and applaud everyone as they come by and wave, which is what I did for many hours. Well, a lot of folks, former UW students, recognized me and came over. And there, you know, folks from La Crosse, from Ashland, from Sheboygan, from Racine, from Oxford, just all over the state. And I suddenly was able to grasp what was going on here. It was very interesting. If we go to the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
yes.
Richard Dreyfuss and all those folks weren't sure why, but they were compelled to get to Wyoming to Devil's Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And people felt that compulsion to come to the state capitol. They felt something deep inside of them about what was going on in their state. And I'd hear these stories. People, you know, one woman said, I haven't voted in 30 years. Someone else said, you know, I didn't think it made much difference. Governor Walker sounded good. I voted for him. I'm really sorry I did. This is my way of trying to make up for it. Repeated like that over and over.
Do you think some of the protests we saw in February, March were kind of the last protests of the baby boomer generations that you and I were part of in the 60s, Paul?
I hope so.
Kind of a last hurrah?
I hope so in the sense that I hope that there's never anything of this magnitude happening again. And the other thing is this. Just as in the 60s, we're going to see this taking place in different venues, different forms. In other words, it's not going to be protests every week or every month with those kinds of turnouts. It may manifest itself in other ways. For example, we've got the recalls coming up.
Yes.
We've got the regularly scheduled elections a year from November.
Do you think some of those GOP senators that voted for the collective bargaining changes will be tossed from office?
You know, I just don't know. I guess I'm enough of a politician to say, unless I saw the polls.
Yeah.
But one thing I'm convinced of, there is going to be so many millions of dollars, not just Wisconsin, from all over the country pouring into those elections, that while the money will obviously have some effect, it may end up the dollars on both sides neutralizing one another, which means who's ever best organized on the ground, face to face, will win this thing.
The St. Norbert poll, the last one I saw, showed a divided state, 47-48, and that's margin of error on Scott Walker. Where can the governor go from here in terms of can he gain more support, or has the die been cast in terms of his political future?
I don't think he can raise his popularity. I think that in that sense the die is cast. And if I were a Republican strategist, very frankly, what I would work to do, besides turning out my own vote, I'd put a lot of effort into voter suppression, trying to keep the anti-Walker vote down. But
do you think that's why he just signed photo ID to vote?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about photo ID being a mechanism designed to suppress the vote. But back during the days of the protests, when Governor Walker was basically minimizing their impact and saying, got a lot of out-of-state agitators and all this sort of stuff, I genuinely, with all my heart, wish that he could have stood on those curbs with me. Mm-hmm. And yes, you'd see six people from the Screen Actors Guild in Los Angeles and 43 plumbers from Chicago and a handful of electricians or firefighters from Columbus, Ohio, but these are our people. This was Wisconsin. You know, 98% of those people marching around the square are his voters, his supporters, his citizens. And I wish he'd come down and been able to feel that and understand that.
The Supreme Court just ruled that the collective bargaining changes will be the law of the state of Wisconsin. What will be the impact on that on the city of Madison, sir?
I think it'll have more effect on the unions than it will on the city. And by that I mean we will continue to respect the bargaining units. We will continue to respect our public employees. I don't know, you know, what their strategies are, but I'll tell you something from all my years in office. And I go back again to make the point that when I was mayor, we were able to run this city with public employee unions at a lower cost than the average in Wisconsin and far lower than the average in the United States. And here's what I know. A strong unionized public workforce is the best thing you can have. I'd rather have a strong union than a weak one. You can bargain, you can make compromises, you can make management innovations with strong, confident public employees. That's where you get your best results. And let me just add one more thing.
Sure.
We did some research. I want to make a couple of points about all this attack on public employees. First of all, Wisconsin workers, along with Oregon workers, do have the best health insurance and do have the greatest retirement benefits of any state in the union. There's no question about that. What's not stated is those workers have below average salaries, and that when you take the compensation package in total, salary, fringe benefits, health insurance, we're just another average state. And so it's very unfair to do these comparisons, because when we were compared to other states, and they would talk about the fringe benefits and they talk about the health insurance, or they do comparables with the private sector, mm-hmm. our people are less compensated. The other point is this, which is to the tune of over $1.1 billion, our state workers are paid far less, given the size of our state, than other states. We are getting quality work out of far fewer employees, bus drivers, police officers, transit workers who are doing the mechanical work on those buses, the school teachers. We are doing more with less. We have been for decades.
As somebody who's watched Madison for decades, you have often seen that Madison, your city, is rated as best city for, and then, you know, these different categories. And that's
raising
nice.
Kids, naked kids, bicycle rides.
Naked bicycle rides, yes, okay. Well, let me ask you, what do you think, do some of these things that we've been talking about, what poses the greatest threat to Madison's quality of life? Which is what these surveys, whether they're valid or not, rate.
Well, let's go back to our mission.
Okay.
Our mission is to create an environment that's safe, that's healthy for children, raising a family, for everyone to work, to play, to recreate, to get an education. Everything's covered. We will have challenges to our public school system. Mm-hmm. We're going to have challenges to maintaining our rivers and lakes and our parks. We're going to have challenges to collecting the garbage, to putting out the fires. Everything is going to get hurt. I know it's going to happen. The optimist in me says we are going to survive, we're going to win this battle, and we're going to go back to the day where we take pride in public service in Wisconsin.
I want to go back to a term that dates both of us, town gown relations. Did you support Chancellor Martin's idea of breaking off the UW and making it?
No, I didn't.
Why, sir?
I was very nervous about it in terms of the privatization of the university. For a long time, 20 years now, I've been very disturbed by the reduction in reduction in state involvement in the university, what it's done to the cost of education. Keep in mind, for a Big Ten university, our tuition's not that bad. Mm-hmm. However, when I say that not that bad, it's not that bad compared to the other Big Ten schools. It's horrible in terms of students from middle-class families without financial aid. And we are really hurting in terms of our ability to provide financial aid, to provide not just student loans, but work opportunities for our students. That concerns me, and a great research university that we are, and we will continue to be a great research university. I'm very concerned for the undergraduate student body.
I want to respect your time, but I have always appreciated how much of a student of government you are. So let's do a little pop quiz on some national issues.
Oh, good God.
Obamacare. Good or bad?
I support the president's health plan.
Why?
Because, one, we've got to improve the accessibility of health care in this country. Economically, we can't afford not to raise healthy children. It's that simple. We can't afford to neglect heart disease, treatment for cancer at early stages. And prevention is the key to doing that. And by getting accessibility to health care, we address prevention. I mean, for an industrialized nation, we unfortunately have great health care for those who can afford it. but for millions, tens of millions, we don't.
And new subject, if the president asked you how much of a troop withdrawal in Afghanistan he should announce tonight, you would advise?
At least 15 to 25%.
15 to 25%.
Yeah, at least.
You wouldn't advise all of our 99,000 troops?
I don't know strategically enough of what's going on militarily, but if I were the president, I mean, I would be working as diligently as possible to turn over military control to the Afghan government, and let's get that $125 billion back into this country for infrastructure and education.
Just two more national issues. Climate change. How severe a problem is it?
I think it's a very severe problem. It's going to change the cost of doing business, the cost of using oceans. It's going to increase energy costs. I just got back from the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and you know, it's real interesting because the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the hundreds of mayors around this country are unanimous in supporting programs that address climate change, mm-hmm. regardless of political party. When you look at it that way, it's not a partisan issue.
And the last national issue, I promise, the growing gap between the rich and poor in America?
It's worse than it's been in our lifetime, and something must be done about it. And this is one of the things that concerns me about what Governor Walker has done. It's one of the things that concerns me about some of the national programs. What good is it going to do to be a bazillionaire in this country in 10 or 15 years if 60-70% of the people can't afford their housing, can't afford to feed their families? Henry Ford was not a nice guy, but he was compassionate in one regard where it came to his pocketbook. He knew that if he paid his workers enough, they could afford to buy his cars.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is lost for a lot of these people.
And then I guess my final question, when we do this interview a year from now, you'll have a good first year as mayor if
we can get through these budget cuts.
If you can get through the budget cuts.
Yeah.
And then, can I ask one more and then I'm done, I promise? You campaigned, you made crime an issue in your bid for this office.
Poverty more than crime.
Poverty more than crime. Can you explain that and then?
Yes, I can. When I left office 14 years ago, somewhere around 27-28% of the Madison Public Schools children mm-hmm. were in households that were below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
During this campaign, 51% of the kids in the Madison Public Schools are in households below the poverty
Almost
line.
Almost doubled.
The number has grown astounding. And the problem is, going to the state formulas, you know, evaluation of wealth of a community is in the buildings. Well, every time we build another $30 million building in Madison, it casts a shadow and it does not affect the pocketbooks of households with $18,000 and $25,000 a year incomes.
Paul Soglin, Mayor of Madison, welcome back to the game.
Thank you.
You sound like you're glad to be back.
I am so grateful to be here.
Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.